CNN Radio, I'm Bill Caiaccio. Top story, the Martin Luther King Jr. National Memorial is being dedicated in Washington. I want to be more and more like the ceremony Jesus. Is underway right now. President Obama will speak later this morning. Martin Luther King Jr. Martin Luther King III says we should all remember his father's call for peace.
Civil disobedience did not necessarily begin with our father, but certainly he was one of those in our society that taught us the value of nonviolence.
The ceremony was postponed in August because of Hurricane Irene. Former President Bill Clinton celebrated his 65th birthday with a bash in Hollywood.
I've had the most unusual life. I was born after World War II in the second poorest state in the country, into a family that never had a college graduate, and poof, lightning struck one time after another.
There were musical tributes from Lady Gaga, Kenny Chesney, and Bono. Some American troops are coming home from Iraq much sooner than expected. It involves a dispute between the U.S. and Iraq over legal immunity for soldiers who stay beyond the withdrawal deadline at the end of the year. The decision by Nevada Republicans to move their caucus date ahead of New Hampshire's primary has upset some of the GOP presidential candidates. CNN's T.J. Holmes says one will boycott the CNN debate in Las Vegas Tuesday.
Former Utah Governor John Huntsman. Now, he claims he wants to do this for one to focus on New Hampshire. Going to spend all of his time, money, energy, and efforts there. But also, he says he's upset with the state of Nevada and the GOP here for putting their caucuses on January 14th.
There are now Occupy Wall Street rallies in several cities in the U.S. and around the world. The protests started 30 days ago in New York. For news anytime, go to CNN.com. This is CNN Radio.
At Advance Auto Parts, we don't do anything just part way. We go full throttle. When we want to give you a good deal on your next oil change, we don't just sell you a few cans of oil. No, we'll sell you a 5-plus quarts jug of Valvoline conventional motor oil for $13.99 after mail-in rebate. Yeah, a jug. Not a kettle or pail or even a crock, but a jug. Just saying the word jug feels like you're getting things done. Speaking of done, we're not. Advance will also throw in a high-quality oil filter with that jug. Free! And this isn't some doily of a filter that you wouldn't use to brew your Auntie Mabel's tea. No, this is a Purelator Classic oil filter with a value up to $11.99. Think those other places work as hard to bring you deals like this? Well, get back on your unicorn and ride on down to your gumdrop castle, because you're living in fantasy land, man. Everything you need for a complete oil change is $13.99. Service is our best part.
Advance Auto Parts.
Free rebate price $20.99. See store for details.
Since 1886, the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington, D.C. has been helping children in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Now they are visited by over 3,000 children every day. The club teaches character and leadership development and arts education. No child is turned away for being unable to pay the $25 fee, and the club needs your help to make this happen. Give a gift online at bgcgw.org. The life you lift up today will be the life that brings a better world tomorrow. This message is brought to you by GEICO and Federal News Radio.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday here on Federal News Radio at 10 a.m. Please join me this week for my special guest and partner, John Dedon, trusts and estates expert at Odin Feldman and Pittleman. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by the full-service law firm of Odin Feldman and Pittleman, located in Fairfax and serving the entire D.C. metro area. If you'd like to know more about us, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
My wife's monthly trip to the beauty salon was really adding up. I mean, between dyeing her roots and trimming the dead ends, we were going dead broke. So to save some money, I'm cutting it for her while she sleeps. Shh. No, don't wake up yet. Go to sleep, go to sleep. You're almost gorgeous. Oh, she is going to love this.
There's an easier way to save. Get online. Go to geico.com. Get a quote. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Soon, this little baby I'm singing to sleep will start to walk. Before I know it, I'll be dropping her off at school, beaming when she walks up to accept her diploma, or holding back tears as she takes those big steps down the aisle. But before she takes all those steps, she and thousands like her will need you to take yours. Join March for Babies to help make her steps possible.
March for Babies!
Start your team today at marchforbabies.org.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired, entertained, and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, along with my co-host, Dave Taylor, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney, and we're broadcasting today from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. And we have a great lineup of guests for you on our show today, including Bob Hostetler, who's the Mid-Atlantic Managing Partner for Tatum, Ahmed Ali, CEO of Testa Science and Technology Corporation, Jay Chawla, who's the Chairman and CEO of Ace Info Solutions, and Danny Abinajum, who's the president of Lebanese Taverna. Joining us first is a young man by the name of Bob Hostetler, who's the Mid-Atlantic Managing Partner for a company called Tatum. What is Tatum, Bob?
Tatum is a national 20-year-old professional services organization that provides CFO services to companies in transition.
A 20-year-old professional services firm focusing on CFOs.
Correct.
How big or small are you guys today?
We have about 600 professionals that are part of Tatum at this point in time, working out of 10 offices in the United States.
So focusing on CFOs, I mean, I love the line off your website, helps companies maximize the office of the CFO with a singular focus on accelerating business performance. Just what does that mean?
That's a, you know, I think it's a good summary of what the firm does. We are focused, and when we say we're focused on the office of the CFO, it goes back to our origins as a firm. We are, in general, 20 to 25-year experienced veterans of the CFO office, meaning we've operated in the C-suite. Our typical professionals come out of public accounting, have worked in 5 to 7 companies over a 20 to 25-year span, and can rapidly step into any company in any particular industry segment and add value and leadership immediately, particularly in that finance function, the CFO role in the organization.
I mean, most people would probably think the CFO just counts the beans. I mean, what's the misperception we should clear up right now about CFOs?
Operating in organizations tend to be the financial leadership within the firm. Your typical CEO is going to be carrying the strategy or the vision of the firm, but how you actually get there and the fiscal resources, meaning the money, the assets, and so forth of the organization, how do we accomplish this vision, rests with the CFO working in concert with the rest of the C-suite.
What makes companies need someone in this interim or temporary space?
It's an interesting concept or reality that the average life expectancy of a CFO runs about 28 months. So within companies, about every 3 years, they're facing a vacancy in that position. That can be caused by the individual moving on, but it could also be caused by the need for someone different because their organization has changed so dramatically.
Right. How long have you been with the firm, Bob?
I have been with Tatum 8 years.
And did you start as the managing partner?
I started in 2003 as the managing partner here in the Mid-Atlantic, yes.
And what led you to the firm?
My background was in public accounting and also had been the chief financial officer for 3 software companies. In the early 2000, we moved from the Raleigh-Durham, Chapel Hill area of North Carolina up here. My wife in a change with my wife's position. And that's when I was first introduced to Tatum. Seemed like a good opportunity. In my past, I had my own public accounting firm, and this provided an opportunity to kind of be in a leadership role again in a professional services firm.
So why get into finance and accounting in the first place?
Good question. In my sophomore year at the University of North Carolina, My intention had been to sort of follow in my dad's footsteps and major in business administration. One of the courses you have to take is accounting. And while I wasn't necessarily thrilled with accounting, I liked the professor very much. And at a party that he hosted, he approached me and suggested that I should major in accounting, and I was a little bit perplexed by why he suggested that. And he said, well, if you go into accounting, you will be responsible for the numbers, and the numbers is where the power lies in an organization.
What made that attractive to you?
Well, the power in an organization was attractive to me, and I guess in a visceral way, I wanted to be where there was influence and kind of in the center of an organization. And
where did that start showing up? How young were you when you wanted to be at the power, the center, and the influence of things?
Early on.
How early?
I think probably we're talking even third or fourth grade.
Tell us about that.
A leadership role in the classroom or on the playing field. I was serious about things, and I can remember particularly a time, when it came to competition, when it came to play, particularly baseball at that point in time, was extremely important to me. And I was in a running competition with a young man from another one of the classes in the fifth grade for the home run king. And in between playground breaks, we'd be keeping track of how many I hit, how many he hit, and so forth. So it's leadership to me just seemed to be where I wanted to be. That was down in my guts.
Where'd you grow up?
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
What was Dad doing back then?
Dad was in sales. He sold steel strapping, which was what you found around brick bundles or refrigerator boxes and so forth.
So that sounds like a pretty stable environment.
Well, actually, I think through no design, we moved, and I was in 13 different schools through my first 12 years.
13 different moves in 12 years.
Right.
What did you take away from that experience?
The one was that usually the process would begin with some being sad and disappointed that we were going to move, but usually within about an hour, I would come to the conclusion that this was a new opportunity and brighter horizon. So I approached them optimistically, really did. It was, and it just seemed to be that, you just go with the flow. Things are going to change. Some things are going to be better. Some things may be worse. But you're also going to learn some new things.
Do you think that impacted the business that you're in now? The way that you find yourself giving to a professional life?
I think that does impact, if you will, a perspective on longevity. I can relate to this 28-month rule relative to CFOs, that things change because business conditions and business life cycles change. Things, particularly today, nobody is going to be with a company 35 years and retire with a gold watch. So that three-year life cycle seems to really kind of suit, and that kind of goes all the way back to my early background.
Yeah. Bob, you mentioned earlier that you're something about your father. What about your mother's influence on your getting into this?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, too. One of the key things that I believe in is transparency and honesty. And, at the University of North Carolina, the motto there is to be rather than to seem, to actually be. And my mom, as I guess many moms, had a unique ability to know when I was telling the truth or not. And so I was conditioned and learned early on it was a whole lot better to be rather than to seem and to tell the truth. And so as you know, as it moves into the role and in the profession I chose, it was towards trying to get to the truth about operations and about how businesses were doing and so forth. So it's kind of a thread through the whole thing.
Real quickly, what was the toughest thing you've ever accomplished?
What immediately comes to mind when I'm asked that question was an opportunity I had to assume a presidency of a early-stage software company that had been an acquisition by a larger company. The acquisition was a mom-and-pop. The mom-and-pop had been exited out of the company, and the company was fairly much in chaos. So they needed stability. They needed leadership. That's why I was brought in. They also needed some fiscal responsibility, which was another reason. The second day I was there, we got a call from a Secretary of State that let us know that we had been awarded the largest contract in that company's history and in the new parent company's history. So, and that the next day we had to be in the capital city of that state for signing of the contracts and so forth. I took my new team with me, a couple of individuals, and as we flew out that early the next morning, we're going up in the elevator into the boardroom of this facility, I'm hearing a knocking sound in the elevator, and I thought it was the elevator, but I realized it was my director of development's knees were banging together. I looked over at him and said, "Are you okay?" And he whispered to me, "We don't have this software." So that was the beginning of a very exciting time. I will say we delivered it on time. In a very rapid fashion, but that was the toughest challenge that I think.
What's the website address, Bob?
Our website is www.tatumllc.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Bob Hostetler, who's the Mid-Atlantic Managing Partner for Tatum. I'd like to thank my co-host, Dave Taylor, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Don't forget to visit our website, Executive Leaders Radio, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight.
This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your Business Spotlight. Today's guest is
Steve Oviatt, Battlefield Telecom Consulting.
You beat me to the punch, Steve. What is Battlefield Telecom Consulting?
I've been in business for a while, and what I'm working with is helping customers cut their telecom-related expenses and improve their bottom line.
How do you do that?
I act as their agent with the carriers. For example, if your organization is spending $2,000 a month or more on telecom-related expenses, be it voice, data, or cellular, I'll go in and negotiate with the carriers on your behalf to cut those expenses.
And why do the carriers listen to you?
Because I'm talking for the customer. And with all of the competition that's going on in the market these days between all the providers, for example, the cable companies and the carriers and the like, they're trying to keep market share.
Yeah. Do you have an interesting success story you can share with us, Steve?
Oh, God, I've got a million of them. But one of the best ones is, just to give you a typical idea, a local retailer here in the D.C. area had done some downsizing within the last decade or so, but had never looked at their telecom-related expenses, thinking they were fixed costs like many CFOs do. Mm-hmm. We were able to find 50% savings. They were even able to stay with their same carrier, and we were also able to get a PBX vendor in to show them how they could cut costs on their internal equipment.
Is that an unusual success story, or is that somewhat typical of the kind of savings you can provide?
That's typical. I can find savings 70% of the time. 90% of the time, I can keep you with your same vendor.
Thanks very much, Steve. We've been speaking with Steve Oviatt of Battlefield Telecom Consulting. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is Peter Schwartz, along with my co-host, David Taylor, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Joining us for this segment is a gentleman by the name of Jay Chawla, who's the chairman and CEO of Ace Info Solutions. What is Ace Info Solutions, Jay?
Ace Info Solutions is a federal government IT contractor. We are about 325, 300-plus employees company. We expect to do about $60 million revenue. Our primary client is federal government, you know, varying from civilian agencies such as U.S. Department of Agriculture, Commerce, Justice, to DHS, Department of Homeland Security agencies such as Coast Guard, Transportation Security agencies, and some Air Force client as well.
What's the primary product or service that you deliver to the government?
We provide a turnkey life cycle IT solutions. Mm-hmm. They include software development, systems engineering, help desk, and those types of. And we are prime contractor on most of our work. Mm-hmm. That means we take ownership of those products and we deliver those services.
When was the company founded?
Company was founded in December 2000 by myself and another gentleman, Nar Kopla, who is my classmate back in India while we went to engineering together in India.
So you started the company with a partner about a little over 10 years ago?
Yes, I did.
Why?
Did.
Why start a business?
Well, I think entrepreneurialism was always in my blood. You know, if I go back, my father was a businessman in India, I had this tendency to take ownership of projects. Whenever I was working on any project, I immediately took on a managerial role take ownership and to deliver those projects. And I always wanted to start the companies. And I think it came from my parents' background.
So tell us a little bit about your parents and the background. What was your dad doing back in India?
My dad was a contractor. You know, he's retired now in India. He was doing more of a civil engineering contracts and with various agencies there. And he had a tough time, actually, growing up. You know, his father, my grandfather, I never saw him. He died when my dad was about 2 years old. And my grandmother took upon herself to raise him, put him through the school and college, and he had a tough time.
So that's very unusual for a child to be able to be successful under those kinds of circumstances, isn't it?
Yeah, I think all the credit goes to really my grandmother.
Yeah, did you get to know your grandmother very well?
Yeah, I did. The last time I saw her when I first came to this country back in 1985. But she was instrumental in my growing up as well. Mm-hmm. You know, she used to make sure that I not only go to school, come back, do my homework, but I go to farm. You know, when I come back from school at 5 p.m. and 6 p.m., she makes sure she makes sure we go to farm, do some farm work, come back and do the homework.
So she was quite the strict authoritarian type of person, kept you under the gun.
She was, and I think I got a lot of qualities. She explained, I learned what hard work is, she did that. A lot of times I used to go to my dad. Dad, you know, my grandma is asking us to do that. I can't do that. I had to do my homework. But my dad will go back and say, he wouldn't comment. He wouldn't do anything against my grandmother. So,
Jay, how old were you when you came to this country, and why did you come here?
I was about 22 and a half, 23 years old when I first came to this country. The primary reason for coming to this country is to graduate program, to graduate studies at NGIT. I did my bachelor's in engineering in India. After the bachelor's program, you know, I had options either to look for a job or go and do some higher studies in India or higher studies overseas, such as here in the United States. And I thought doing higher studies here would give a lot of exposure to the world and also get a better quality of education.
What made you transition into the IT side?
My background is in the civil engineering. My first couple of jobs was in the civil engineering field. And I was a licensed professional engineer in multiple states. But I was as I was doing the engineering work at these companies, there was a lot of focus on IT. IT was becoming more part and parcel of the engineering works. So I got into the IT area, and I liked doing that. I went to some more formal education in the graduate programs and at Nova College, community colleges, and then transitioned into IT world. I transitioned into the IT world more from the managerial side. I didn't start from the bottom programmer, but using the background of managerial background I gained in the engineering, I transferred over into the IT world.
You say you have a partner that you knew from way back in your college days in India?
Yes. You know, he's a Nar Kopala. He and I went to college in India together, same batch, same class, and so we partnered up. You know, he came here for higher studies and started working in engineering field and slowly moved into the IT area.
So what happened? You guys were sitting around having a beer one day and said, let's go start a company?
Very similar. You know, we were looking at some of the, you know, talking about our experiences in the IT world, and we said, you know, we are working hard. You know, we do 12-hour, 14-hour days, and I was doing the entire life
cycle. So what were the first days like? You guys, you know, there's a whole big thing between starting a company and running and going successfully.
Yes, and one year or so was a very slow start. You know, he had a job, I had a job. I was working for Bearing Point when we first registered the company. But once I left the Bearing Point, you know, we had this company with no clients, no money coming in, right?
How did you finance it?
Financing was all was done personally. You know, personal financing. We started from my home basement. Right, you know, we had the expenses were telephone, fax machine, email account. You know, that was it. Other than that, it was all sweat equity. You know, working 10, 12-hour days, trying to get potential customers. And one of the expenses initially was joining the $100 Chamber of Commerce. You know, 100 and some bucks entry fee, but that paid off. One day, coming back from meeting a client, you know, there was a $100 Chamber of Commerce event, and I was almost debating whether to go or not. Rather than going straight on 66, I took the exit and went to this event and met a guy, you know, potential client. I was there and I was talking to him, you know, can we introduce, I asked him, can you introduce me to your CTO or the IT person? And he gave his number and name and said, feel free to call him, you know, call him up. And I did that, and then they are still a client. We started with them about 8-9 years ago, and they're still our client.
Yeah. We get a lot of first-generation immigrants who have started business and been very successful on this show. Why do you suppose being a first-generation immigrant makes you most likely to succeed as a business owner?
I think when we come here to this country, we want to prove ourselves. You know, working through this environment, you know, new culture, new atmosphere, and you know, different weather conditions, and you are driven. You want to prove it to yourself that you can succeed in this world, and that's one of the reasons we always wanted to start a company, work hard. Do not expect returns, immediate returns at least, not just short term, but the longer term strategic things.
Was there ever a moment in the early days when you thought, well, maybe I made a mistake and I shouldn't have done this?
No, I think we always liked it. There was tough times at the beginning. One of the examples was when I told folks we started a company, it was just dot-com bust. You know, people were just, you know, discouraging. Starting a company now, you must be kidding. You know, it's tough to get a job. How can you start a company? And those types of things gave me more motivation. I should succeed. I have to prove it to myself and to those folks, doubters, that we can succeed. So that gave me more motivation. And that leads to, you know, people ask me how many hours you work, and I say, what do you mean work? You know, I love this. This is my passion, really. Yeah. I don't treat this as a work. If I treat this as a work, I can never succeed. You know, initially you are getting negative pay. You know, you're putting money, but you're not getting anything back. So if you convert that into an hourly rate, you know, it's a negative hourly rate. So I can never look at it that way.
What's the most difficult thing you've ever had to accomplish?
Starting a company or
anything, you know, when that question comes up, what's the most difficult thing you've ever had to accomplish?
Going back to my, you know, educational days, and when I was trying to get into engineering college in India, it was very, very tough, you know, to get in. There were very few seats available, lots of competition, and it was the ratio of 1 to 35 applicants to get in. And I couldn't get in first time after my high school, or they call it intermediate education, to the engineering school. So I have to take a year off. All I did was prepare for this entrance exam to engineering. And worked, you know, literally studied 20 hours a day with 4 hours of sleep and got in. And I feel, I think that changed the rest of my life.
Yeah. Is your grandmother aware of your success?
She was aware of the success of getting into engineering college. She was very proud of me. And she was aware that, you know, she knew when I was coming here. I didn't want to meet her a few days after I knew I was coming here. I met her an hour or so, not hour, maybe 4 hours before.
If she was sitting here listening to this interview, what would you like to say to her right now?
And I get emotional. Grandma, you know, I learned a lot from you. All my success is because of your hard work and the motivation that you have taught me.
What's the website address, Jay?
It's aceinfosolutions.com. It's www.aceinfosolutions.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Jay Chawla, who's the chairman and CEO of Ace Info Solutions. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Taylor, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Don't forget to visit our website, Executive Leaders Radio, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is
Sophie Pyle.
And Sophie, who are you with?
I'm with Vox Worldwide.
What is Vox Worldwide?
Vox Worldwide is my company. I do social media maintenance for a variety of different clients.
Media maintenance. What the heck is that?
Yes. So maybe a company doesn't want to have their marketing person working full time on their Facebook and Twitter accounts, which are very important today that every business have one. So what I do is I maintain their Facebook and Twitter accounts and also try to optimize other tools so that they are getting the most out of today's social media programs.
How long have you been in business?
I've been in business since I graduated college in 2009, and it's been booming. People love the internet.
You started a business right out of college?
Yes.
How's it going?
It's going well. It took a lot of struggles in the beginning, but I learned a lot. It's hard having your own business.
Is there a particular success story you can reference?
Yes. My biggest client acquisition yet so far has been guestofaguest.com, which is owned by Cameron Winklevoss of the famous Winklevoss twins, and Rochelle, she's a wonderful boss up in New York is where it's grounded, but I'll be doing a lot of coverage of Fashion's Night Out tonight in Georgetown, so I'm really excited about that.
Mm-hmm. Why should companies be considering social media as a part of their strategy?
It's another excellent marketing tool that's relatively inexpensive. It can be free if you have the right tools and the right things in place, so something that every business should have.
Uh-huh. And if someone wanted to get a hold of you, how could they reach you?
They can reach me at Vox Worldwide, VOXWorldwide.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and this is we've been speaking with Sophie Pyle, who is the CEO of Vox Worldwide, and this has been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, along with my co-host, David Taylor, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. I'd like to welcome our next guest, Ahmed Ali, who's the CEO of Testa Science and Technology Corporation. What is Testa Science and Technology Corporation, Ahmed?
Testa Science and Technology Corporation is a government services contractor, so we focus on providing services to various government clients in the field of cybersecurity, information assurance, software development, and program management.
How old is the company?
Testa was formed in 2005, mm-hmm. So we've been in business for about several years now, and we've seen rapid growth, doubling in size pretty much every year.
Wow. How big or small are you today?
Today, we're slightly under 100 people, but we expect to cross that threshold within the next, before the end of the year, because due to some new awards and some things in the pipeline.
Uh-huh. How did the word Testa, what does that mean?
Thank you for asking that question. Not everybody asks. So Testa actually is a river that flows through Asia. It flows through several countries, Nepal, India, Bangladesh. And when I started the company, I wanted to create a name that had a meaning. So I named the company after my father. Testa is a river where he was actually born in a village next to the Testa River. So I wanted to do something in honor of my father because he worked so hard to get us to where we are today.
So let's go back to the early days. Tell us a little bit about your dad and your background.
Sure. Our background, we came to this country, just myself, my mother and father. I don't have any siblings. We came in 1976. My father was an electrical engineer.
From where?
From Bangladesh.
Bangladesh.
He worked at a power plant there as the chief engineer there. Then when we came to this to the United States. He pursued his further education and worked in the engineering field in the private side, then transitioned to government service as the chief electrical engineer in one of the government agencies in D.C. government. And after that, he retired just a few years ago. And
so was it easy for your dad, though, to come to the United States and just transfer a skill set right into the U.S. mainstream?
There was a little bit of challenge, but it took some time. But he was very determined, had a great education, and he got some good jobs initially and was able to grow after that and find some great opportunities. And when he joined the government, he really fell in love with the government and his position there and his duty to service for the country.
Right. And you grew up in Maryland.
Yes, I grew up in Maryland pretty much my entire life, except for the period when I was in the military.
Uh-huh. And but you moved around a lot, I understand.
We moved around a lot within Maryland, within Prince George's County, within Montgomery County. So really between those two counties, we moved around a lot. As a child, I went to nine different schools from the period of kindergarten through 12th grade. So there was a lot of moving to different locations. But once we stabilized after my high school period, I was able to pursue my education in college.
So what is it like to be an only child and move around that frequently?
There definitely was some challenges. I do have quite a lot of cousins that were here, so that was helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So I did have a lot of good family support. My parents were always very caring and always looked out for me, but it was definitely not easy moving from school to school and apartment to apartment until we were stabilized. And then we finally moved to Bethesda, Maryland, and my father bought a house there, and that's where we kind of fell into place.
Mm-hmm.
I understand you put yourself through college. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, when I entered college, I started off at a community college for a little bit, then transferred to Howard University. From there, went to University of Maryland. So during that whole period when I was in engineering school, I basically had to support myself. My parents, they did have some other obligations financially, so I tried to create as less burden on them as I could. I worked full-time and went to college full-time. And
then you decided to join the Navy.
I did. I was in my third year in engineering school in University of Maryland, and I had a passion to join the service. I've always wanted to be a naval pilot, and I actually was also looking for financial support to support myself to go to school, and a couple of friends who were in the military told me this is an option to look into. I looked into it, fell in love. I couldn't become a pilot because I didn't have the best vision at that time to get in, but so I told the Navy, give me the most difficult job you have, and the most difficult job they have in the engineering electronics field was in the radar world. So I became an Aegis Spy radar specialist deployed on a guided missile destroyer station in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii.
How long were you in the Navy?
I was in the Navy 6 years active duty, from 1995 to 2001.
What do you think that experience taught you?
That experience was, to me, tremendous. It was amazing, and it really helped me focus in my life. The U.S. military is an outstanding organization of people and troops and soldiers and airmen and sailors. And I have to tell you, before I joined the military, I really wasn't too focused on what I wanted to do in my life. I knew I wanted to stay in the technical field. But I tell you, when I got in the military, it really helped me put a lot of focus in my life as to what I wanted to do, not only in my military career, but post-military career.
So why get out of the military if you liked it so much?
That's a great question. I was got married in my last year of the military. I got picked up for this officer program, but I had to recommit another 4 years out at sea on deployment. So after finishing three deployments, my wife pretty much kind of said, well, I'm tired of you being gone all the time. So it was a tough decision because I really loved that camaraderie in the military. It was part of my life, so it was definitely a tough transition. But once I got out...
So you then went back to finish your college education and graduate school?
I did. When I got out of the military, I worked for a private company at the U.S. Naval Academy complex, and I went to school at night at the University of Maryland complex in Maryland, and I finished my education. And after that, finished my bachelor's, then used my GI Bill to pay for it, and then I went into government service, became a government employee.
I understand your company is a service-disabled, veteran-owned small business. How did you come to be disabled and need to...
Sure. So after doing a couple of tours overseas in the Gulf, I did injure myself in my hand and my back, hurt my back pretty bad and injured my hand. I didn't think too much of it. I thought they would slowly heal. So when I got out of the service about a year later, things started getting a little bit worse. So I went and had got it checked out with the doctors, and they said I need to have an operation. So I had a couple of metallic screws in my bones. I have a bad back. So it was a period where it was a challenging period during that time, going to graduate school at night and going through this operation.
Yeah, you talked a little bit about that in the green room, where you had also a desire to get into the FBI, but it didn't work out for you because of this injury. Say a little bit about that.
Right. So when I finished my when I completed my last year of undergraduate education and was working full time, my goal when I got out of the service is I wanted to be an FBI agent. I wanted to join the bureau. I wanted to do something for my country. So I thought, and the FBI has always attracted me. But after I got injured, I wouldn't have passed the medical waiver to get in. So I had to find another course in life. But if I wasn't an FBI agent, I wanted to go into business because business also attracted me. So I decided to focus on business.
You told us that wasn't an easy transition for you, that for a period of about 2 years, you kind of were drifting.
I was drifting after the operation because as a child and in the military and in high school and college, I was really into sports. Played a lot of football, basketball, baseball, you name it. Weight training, everything. But after my operation, I couldn't do any of those things. So it was a period where I was going through a little slump period. So I decided, well, do I let this, how do I, this is just another challenge, and how do I progress from this and move forward? And
but that must have been quite a setback. I mean, your dreams had been kind of tabled.
Yes, the dreams were kind of sidelined, and so I went through a period of about a year or two. I wasn't sure what exactly I wanted to do moving forward. I had a great job, so I decided to go back and finish my graduate degree, move from the engineering world to the IT security world.
Yeah. So why start a business in the first place?
I actually wanted to start a business back when I was in the service. I thought about it, but after having so many years of experience in the private sector and the government world and working for the intelligence community, I thought it was the right time to start one, and I always wanted to make a difference. I wanted to grow something from scratch and make it a respectable company and give back to the community.
What were the early days like?
The early days of growing the business was challenging. I actually spun off from a large defense contractor as a one-person company, spun off from them. They gave me my first contract. So the biggest challenge was really financials, was to get a loan. Nobody would give me a loan at that time, so I had to dip into all the savings I had. I had to close my 401k and use all that money.
Was that a scary time for you and the wife?
It was a very scary time because she was not sure what I was doing. And I tried to explain it to her. I don't think she really understood it. She really wanted me to keep a stable job and spend time with the family.
So what was it like to go through that period of uncertainty for you?
It was very challenging. It was unpredictable. But because of my military background, I'm the type of person who's very adamant when I make a decision. Mm-hmm. They're always calculated decisions. They're never shooting from the hip. But I study something very well. I look at all the positive and negatives. But I always see the world in a glass mostly full.
Yeah,
And I'm a very optimistic person.
Was there a moment in time when you knew that the business was going to work?
After about the second year, I realized the business has a life because I started slowly growing. But the key to any business and to any business in this industry is the people that you bring on board. Mm. And I brought some great people on board, and they really helped me to grow the business. So I can't take all the credit. But I can take some credit for the direction and vision of the company. But really, the people I was able to surround myself with and bring on board, they really helped me and the company to grow. And they were very ethical people.
What's your proudest moment been up till now?
The proudest moment, I've had quite a lot of proud moments. But my proudest moment, I believe, is just growing a company in this industry, which is not only flourishing, but is well-respected, and the fact that we give back to a lot of children's causes. I've always wanted to do philanthropic things, and one thing that this business has enabled me to do is give back to the community, especially to the children's children throughout the world,
right,
in Africa and Asia and things of that. And we create orphanages, we donate to children's causes. So to me,
that's great. What's the website address, Ahmed?
The website address is www.tistatech.com, TISTATECH.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Ahmed Ali, who is the CEO of Tista Science and Technology Corporation. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Taylor, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight.
This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your Business Spotlight. Today's guest is
Lynette Spano.
And Lynette, who are you with?
I'm with SEI Consulting.
But you're not here to talk about SEI today, are you?
No, I'm not. I'm talking about the new face of America.
And what is or who is the new face of America?
Well, it's a show that it's in a pilot stage right now, and we're marketing the pilot. It is it's a platform to host, for me to be the host, to talk about subjects and various different topics that affect modern-day Americans that include Hispanics.
So the new face of America is you, but it's also a people group, isn't that right?
Absolutely. There are 50 million Hispanics, documented Hispanics in the United States, and undocumented, we think there might be another 10 million. So it's imperative that there is a platform where from the experience of a Hispanic perspective, that there can be, you know, the stories can be told about the accomplishments, the contributions that Hispanics and Latinos have made here in the United States.
Why is now the right time for this show?
The right time is now because contemporary Latino immigrants came in here in 1985 and 1989. Their children today are 20, 25, and 30 years old, and they all, their language is English, and so they all need a forum, a medium where they can tap into that is spoken again from the Hispanic experience.
Is there a business aspect to this? Is there market power behind this group?
Oh, absolutely. The purchasing power for Latinos in the United States they're talking $8 billion in purchasing power. The networks and the broadcasting networks are beginning to realize that it's a market that they've got to pay attention to.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Lynette Spano of SCI Consulting. She's the founder and CEO, but she's also the new face of America.
Absolutely.
This has been Mike Mannion, your host with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, along with my co-host, David Taylor, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Joining us for this segment is a young man by the name of Danny Abinajum, who's the president of Lebanese Taverna. What is Lebanese Taverna, Danny?
Lebanese Taverna is a group of 11 restaurants, three different concepts, a full-service restaurant, cafes, and a market. And we also have a catering operation.
So 11 different stores or restaurants. That's quite a successful little chain you've got there. When was your first one opened?
First one was opened in 1979.
And your parents have been in this country for a long time and just decided to start a restaurant?
We are immigrants, landed in America in 1976, and 3 years afterwards we decided to open the restaurant.
Where are you from?
Beirut, Lebanon.
Mm-hmm. So what was going on in 1976 that caused your family to immigrate?
In 1975, the Lebanese Civil War broke out. And after about a year and a half in the war, Dad decided Lebanon was no longer a safe place to be, especially after his two sons joined the military and were actually going to the front line.
So those two sons were?
Myself and my older brother.
How old were you?
At the time I joined the military, I was 14.
You were 14 and fighting a war?
Yes.
What was that like?
Exciting at first and then terrifying.
Yeah. Say a little bit more about that. I can't imagine that, being 14 and being in an environment like this.
Well, where we lived, we were very close to what's called the Green Line at the time that separated the two areas. And we were living very close to a military base, and a call went out that they needed young men to join the fight. And a neighbor of ours came knocking on our door, says, do you want to enlist? And said, sure. And my brother and I enlisted. It was literally a 5-minute walk from our house, went through a month of training, and then sent out to the front line.
Yeah. So your mom and dad said, enough of this. We're getting the family out of here. How many brothers and sisters do you have?
We're three boys and two girls.
Uh-huh. And you just came to the United States, up and came to the United States.
Yes. We have some background in the United States. My grandmother was actually born in the States, in Youngstown, Ohio. But her and her family immigrated back to Lebanon when she was six. So there was some connection to the United States, and that's how we're able to have...
So you come to the United States. Did you know English?
No.
So what was it like? You're 15 or so when you get to the United States. What was it like to be in this country and not know English?
It was challenging at first, but we had many great people take us in and be really helpful.
Mm-hmm. And so your parents, did they bring a lot of money to the United States?
Well, when we landed on these shores, we had our suitcases and the clothes on our back, and if I remember correctly, about $300 in cash, and that's all we had in this.
And 3 years later, they start their first restaurant. How does that happen?
The two boys at age 15 and 17 got to work right away. Mom and dad got to work right away. Dad got a painting job, painting apartments, and we're able to just save up enough money to put a down payment on a restaurant.
What location is that?
Arlington, Washington Boulevard.
That's your first one?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Were you involved in the business?
I was. Even before the day the door opened, Dad would take me around to translate for him in his negotiations to buy the restaurant.
He did?
Yes.
And what other roles did you play in the restaurant in the early days?
Well, also since the first day, Dad put me in charge of the books and management of the restaurant because, again, he couldn't speak English, and he put me in charge.
And how old were you when you were in charge of the books for the restaurant?
17.
So how was that? What kind of an experience was that?
Other than forgetting to pay the insurance on the car that ultimately burned, it went pretty well.
And so then how soon did your mom and dad start the second restaurant after the first?
Well, it was myself who started the second restaurant.
Good for you. So how old were you when you got that cockamamie idea?
I was 27 at the time. I put myself through college, and I got an economics degree, hoping that I was going to go out in the business world and get a job. And after a few interviews, I realized to start at the bottom was really tough. So I decided to, at that point, to expand the family business.
Ah, and what was that like?
It came against much objection from my father.
He didn't want you to do this, huh?
No.
And you did it anyway?
Did it anyway. There were just too many egos in one little place.
Tell us about Herbert MacArthur. Who is that, and what influence did he have on you?
Well, Herbert was... my first friend in this country, and still one of my best friends. When I first came and took French in school, because I could speak French but not English, and he was, although he was American, he was recently coming back from a long post in Morocco, and he spoke a little bit Arabic. So between the Arabic and the French and some of the English, we were able to communicate, and that we made really good friends, and he was very helpful in, you know, integrating me in this country.
How do you suppose your background in Lebanon helped you become a good businessman here?
Well, America is a country of abundance. Lebanon is a country of scarcity. And we've learned how to use everything we have, every means. We recycle. I mean, recycling is not new to us. Using stale bread in our food is not new to us. You know, we've done that throughout history. And coming to America, it's a country of abundance, and by using these same traits that we were brought up with, we're able to succeed. And also, in America, there's a lot of opportunity. I think people, if all you have to do is just work, and you'll be able to find.
What surprised you most about this country when you got here?
How accepting people were of us. Although many people didn't know what Lebanon was and what Lebanese was, Lebanon was, you know, a small country, and what really put it on the map was the war in Lebanon.
Right.
Before that, people, most people didn't know what Lebanon was, but they were accepting and welcoming, and we were grateful for that.
What was the most challenging part of starting your own restaurant?
First one?
Yeah.
It was extremely challenging because we had to be ambassadors of Lebanese cuisine. People didn't know Lebanese cuisine. Mm. So for us, it wasn't simply about opening and operating a restaurant. It was about inviting people in our doors. And the biggest challenge was how to get people into our doors to try Lebanese food. Once they've tried it, they liked it. But getting them in the door was our biggest challenge. So we were off to a very slow start. It took out about a year and a half of very little sales and very little business until we were discovered by somebody in the Washington Post who wrote a little article on us in the Thursday paper, and everything was history.
So then you started the second restaurant.
10 years later. It took us 10 years. Started the second restaurant after graduating from college.
So that would have been about 1989.
1990, yes.
1990. Yeah. And since then, you've added 9 more locations?
Yes.
Why? What makes this, why build it so big?
I have one of our partners, Hendrik Sir, was a neighbor of mine, and early on when I was opening the second restaurant, I asked him to help me with some projections and so forth. He was really knowledgeable in that field. And he helped me, and he said, you know, once you get a taste for success, you're going to want to repeat it. And I said to Hendrik, I said, my dream is to open this restaurant and just, you know, I'll be happy. But he was right. You know, I got the bug and just wanted to duplicate the success.
How big do you want to get it?
Right now, in its current form, it does about $23 million. We're probably going to stay at that, just do the natural business growth. But we're looking at new concepts to introduce, some quick casual concepts.
How do you spend the bulk of your day today,
these days? I start at the office. This is where a lot of the energy is created. My siblings and partner and other key people start at the office every day. And then every afternoon, about four afternoons a week, I head to one of our units and spend the time with the people there and with the customers.
So your siblings are still involved in the businesses?
Yes.
Since the beginning?
Since the beginning.
How do you keep it together?
Early on, I think we were all trying to make the other be just like us. At least this is how I saw it. And now what we've figured out is that how to capitalize on everyone's individuality and strength, and we build on that.
What's your proudest moment been up till now?
I'd say there have been plenty of proud moments, but a few years back, many years in a row, we were recognized by the restaurant industry for several awards, one of them being Restaurateur of the Year and the Neighborhood Restaurants of the Year and New Restaurants of the Year. We were nominated, I'd say, probably 5 different times, and we've received 3 of those. We won 3 of those awards.
So was your dad still upset with you that you stayed in the family business?
Dad was very proud.
Okay, great. What's the website address?
www.lebanesetaverna.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Danny Abinajim, who's the president of Lebanese Taverna. We've had a terrific lineup of guests on our show today, including Bob Hostetler, who's the Mid-Atlantic Managing Partner of Tatum, Jay Chawla, who's the chairman and CEO of Ace Info Solutions, Ahmed Ali, who's the CEO of Tista Science and Technology Corporation, and finally Danny Abinajim, who's the president of Lebanese Taverna. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Taylor, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney, for helping me structure the interviews today. Don't forget to visit our website, Executive Leaders Radio, for more information about our executive leaders. And I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for otherwise we wouldn't have a radio show. This is Peter Schwartz. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on Federal News Radio. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on Federal News Radio. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated.